Blau.
Knows that Rabbi Blau has the unique experience of having learned with the Rav in his prime in the late 50s and the early 60s as a Talmud in the yeshiva and a smicha student. And then Rabbi Blau had the zuchus to, in a sense, be, I wouldn't say an employee of the Rav, but certainly worked under the Rav as an assistant principal at Maimonides. So he got to interact with the Rav in a different capacity and dealing with different issues. And then got a third zuchus that when Rabbi Blau came back to be the Mashkiach in the late 70s, he once again used as a Talmud in the yeshiva and a smicha student. And then Rabbi Blau had the zuchus to, in a sense, be, I wouldn't say an employee of the Rav, but certainly worked under the Rav as an assistant principal at Maimonides. So he got to interact with the Rav in a different capacity and dealing with different issues. And then got a third zuchus that when Rabbi Blau came back to be the Mashkiach in the late 70s, he once again used to go to shir every day and was involved also in terms of issues that came up in terms of the running of the yeshiva. So Rabbi Blau, I think, has a unique perspective that is very helpful because far beyond what I think many other people who are exposed to the Rav have in terms of seeing the Rav in different tekufos and different contexts and seeing him deal with different issues. And therefore, without further ado, that we ask Rabbi Blau to deliver today's talk.
As I mentioned when I had this chus of speaking at the yeshiva at night about the Rav, as many of my colleagues, fellow Rosh Yeshiva, did, those of us who had were exposed to the Rav Zatzal often were able to grasp a part of his greatness, and hopefully we're not going to confuse that which we understood with the whole. I make no claims that this is the accurate understanding of the Rav's position. It's what I was able to glean both from the written word and from what I observed. The issue that I wanted to speak about is, as indicated in the title, The Man of Halacha and Historical Consciousness, is that if one looks at the Rav's most famous writings, the Ish HaHalacha, The Lonely Man of Faith, one gets an impression of the nature of Halacha and the nature of Jewish philosophy, which is very objective and essentially ahistoric. After all, in the description of the halachic man in the Ish HaHalacha, the Rav talks about an approach to the world which is a priori, halachic constructs which are given in advance. The Rav mentions that the aspiration of the Ish HaHalacha, of the Baal HaHalacha, is expressed mostly in the theoretical halacha, not the practical processes. In fact, the imagery that the Rav uses is he compares the Ish HaHalacha to a theoretical mathematician. And I happen to have a background in math, so I noted which mathematicians the Rav used to illustrate his point. And he used those in the 19th century who discovered non-Euclidean geometries, which were clearly seen as not corresponding to the reality of this world, but purely a theoretical construct, which of course later proved of inestimable value in the development of the theory of relativity and in many areas of modern science, but started as something that someone sort of thought of. What if we rejected the parallel postulate of geometry and suggested an alternative, and what would come from it? And it's, I thought it was a very interesting choice for an example by the Rav, because it very much reflects the notion of dealing with constructs, with abstractions. And in the Rav's learning, there very much was a notion of abstracting out basic principles and not focusing on practicality. In many respects, the Rav was somewhat controversial as a posek because he was so focused on the theory and not so much on practically which way do you do it. And therefore, on the different occasions, he may have come to different conclusions, because his thrust was an understanding of the halacha and not coming to a bottom-line answer whether you can use make tea with a tea bag on Shabbos or not. What was behind it? What was the issue? What were the questions? How did you understand the various shitos, the various opinions of the Rishonim? What principles were applied were more important to him than some of the practical consequences. Not that he didn't understand that we had to have practical consequences. In the latter parts of the Ish HaLacha, and much has been written about the last section being somewhat different, the Rav has a description of tshuva. And in that he focuses on the difference between the halachic concept of tshuva and that of the general religious notion, describing the general religious sense of tshuva as one where the man is passive and it's an act of grace from HaKadosh Baruch Hu, that God forgives man for his sin. And while the Rav acknowledged that's part of tshuva, there is another component, the component of tahara, and the Rav discusses this again in a very interesting article called Kodesh and Chol, where the Rav points out that the man has an active role in the process of tshuva. The man can somehow create a new persona, can change himself. So, to the Rav, there's a dynamic process going on. To the Rav, in this discussion about learning, there's a tremendous focus on creativity. But it's the creativity of the mathematician, right, investigating new alternatives, new constructs, that then turn out to have some practical applications. I think it's fair to say that there's an absence of any sense of history in the Ish HaLacha. A theoretical a priori halacha, of course, doesn't change as time changes. It's not dependent on a particular society. And that really is the impression that many people have of the Rav. The Rav is this very abstract, he was once accused of being a pan-halachist, right, of not acknowledging anything outside of technical halacha. What about the dynamics of life? And that's precisely what I hope to deal with in some of the writings to come. But I want to build up the question first. Look at the lonely man of faith. Certainly a very different presentation than the presentation of Ish HaLacha. I know that the people who write about the Rav write about the question that the Rav seems inconsistent and that the Rav is not always presenting a total worldview that follows through in all the different articles. And there's no question that the accusation is correct. The issue is whether it's a real accusation or not. And I'm going to go just on a slight tangent because it's a very important point. The Rav explicitly makes the point in a footnote in the end of The Lonely Man of Faith and then discusses it a bit more in the halachic mind, that halacha does not, and Judaism doesn't accept the law of the excluded middle. In classical logic, there's truth and falsity. There are only two options. It's either A or not A. And in fact, you prove things mathematically by making a contradiction. Reductio ad absurdum, you eliminate one possibility, since it's either yes or no, so you automatically are left with the other one as the only alternative. The Rebbe makes the point in both these places that halacha doesn't work that way. Halacha accepts the existence, at least, of a third mode besides true and false, or multi-valued logic, and I don't want to get technical. But contradictions are not a problem to the Rav. Halacha is complex, life is complex, contradictions are resolved only by a Kadosh Baruch Hu. In this world, they remain. So having things from different perspectives that don't mesh 100% is not, from the Rav's way of looking at things, the biggest problem. Because life does have contradictions in it, and even halacha acknowledges the existence of contradictions. The Rav in his shir, I don't think ever tried to resolve what was the correct pshat. That wasn't what the shir was about, even though he would suggest an interpretation of pshat of his own beyond that which he found in the sources if he had a new perspective and had to learn the sugya. It wasn't whether the Rambam or the Ravid was right, the Ramban or the Balamor, it was understanding the machlokes, understanding what was the principle, what was the chakira, what was the issue upon which they differed, and then how the sugya would be understood and what would follow from each of the perspectives, not assuming that one was the correct one and the other one some were incorrect. There were both ways of learning the sugya, based on two sets of principles, and each one had to be understood and followed, not decided which one to accept and which one to reject. Again, maintaining different things simultaneously. Now, the lonely man of faith, of course, is a very fine illustration of that, because the famous dual characterization, referring back to the fact that Bereishis has two descriptions of the creation of man, and in contrast to the Bible critics, seeing them clearly not as two accounts by two different authors, Chas v'Shalom, but as two different aspects of man, both of which are true. The famous Adam the First and Adam the Second, or Adam One and Adam Two. And they're all talked about Adam One and the majestic community, man being creator, man a scientist, man conquering the world. And Adam II, the covenantal community, a phrase that the Rav made famous, of a man recognizing his inability to grasp all in the world and being humble before his creator. But the key point is, and this is a line, is a quote, in every one of us abide the two persona, the creative, majestic Adam the First and the submissive, humble Adam the Second. Again, the Rav didn't decide one and not the other. Both are true, even though they're very different. And we contain within us, call it an inner contradiction, but two different persona. The crisis described in The Lonely Man of Faith is caused by modern Western man who rejects Adam the Second. It's there, but it's rejected in modern society. And therefore it causes the religious personality, the person who combines both, to find himself in conflict with modern world, because he has a dimension to which the modern world doesn't accept. So he shares some parts with the modern world, the parts reflected in Adam the First, the creative component, the majestic, the dignified component, but the submissive, the humble, the one in awe of God and one withdrawing, that component being absent in the modern society is a component in which the religious individual who has is out of sorts. He's lonely in a different way than he was earlier, the lonely man of faith. The Rav stresses that the pure faith commitment, which is unchangeable as eternity itself. So once again, we seem to be functioning in almost a theoretic universe where the historic experiences of the Jew or of mankind are essentially irrelevant. In the Isha Halacha, history plays no role. It's all the a priori, right? Pre-existing theoretical construct. In the lonely man of faith, there is some significance to history. It's that within history emerged modern Western society, a society which rejected Adam II. But not that the religious value system interacts directly with history. It's a problem for the religious individual living in such a world which doesn't understand this aspect of religious truth and doesn't understand the covenantal community. Now the halachic mind, which is a work that I'm a bit uncomfortable with using because the Rav wrote it in the early 1940s and put it away in a drawer. And it was printed way over 40 years later when the Rav already was ill, and there is some question whether the Rav would have wanted it printed at that time. Clearly, it's the Rav's writings, but it was his thinking 40 years earlier. It's a hard book to read because it's very technical. Quotes many sources in philosophy of science of people who wrote in the 1930s, whose names no longer are current. So one can get absolutely lost in quotations from people whose writings no one's reading. But there are certain things that I think are very clear. One, that Nachman Rav, and again I'm quoting, objectification reaches its highest expression in the halacha. Again, objective. Not subjective, not changing as society changes, purely objective. Right? What is the goal of religious philosophy? Reconstructing its subjective correlative. Not the how, but the what question. Right? The Rav, in the last section, contrasts the Rambam in the Moreh Nevuchim with the Rambam in the Arach HaZaka. That's the only readable part of it anyway. In the Moreh Nevuchim, the Rambam gives reasons for mitzvahs. Tamei HaMitzvos. In the Yad, the Rambam does not try to explain why the mitzvahs or even how, but what the mitzvahs say. Right? The mitzvahs are what they are. The classic illustration the Rav gives is the Rambam talking, Hilchos Tshuva, talking about shofar, right? That shofar is a remez, there's a remez in the mitzvah of shofar to telling the sleeping person to wake up and to do tshuva. The Rambam does not say that the source of the mitzvah or the reason for the mitzvah of shofar is to wake people up. The mitzvah is the mitzvah, right? It's an objective mitzvah which has its rules. However, one of the effects of the mitzvah on us, what emerges from the mitzvah, is that it has a subjective effect that it causes us to be stirred by the sound of the shofar and to wake up and try to do tshuva. Right? The Rav is adamant to this end. There is only a single source from which a Jewish philosophical Weltanschauung could emerge, the objective order, the halacha. Right? Again, objective halacha remains, obviously going to remain the same throughout history. It actually pre-exists history because it's a theoretical a priori construct. Rav is consistent. However, here the Rav, in certain ways, seems to move from this position. In an article called Kodesh and Chol, that's in the Torah Mother Reader, and it's been reprinted in the newest version of the Shiurei HaRav, the printed one, the new printed one, not the one put out by SOI in 1974, but the one put out this past year, and which was interestingly part of a Yahrzeit Shiur. So the context is very interesting. The Rav discusses two concepts of Kedusha, and he talks about place consciousness and time consciousness. And I'm going to focus on the time consciousness, because here already we're dealing with interacting with the world, with time, with history. Time consciousness already is a historical notion. And the Rav talks about quantitative and qualitative time. Quantitative time, of course, is the time on the clock. Right? A minute goes by in 60 seconds. It's quantitative, measurable time. And there's qualitative time. And in this context, the Rav quotes in Pirkei Avos a statement of Mispah Shonim, Minyan Shonim and Mispah Hadoros from Rabbi Akiva, which talks about all the qualities that a father gives to a child, and says, the who are Kates? And this is the Kates. What is the Kates? And the Rav explains this, and he gives credit to Rabbi Reines in one of his Sfarim for the idea that the Rabbi Akiva, as we well know, was a supporter of the revolt of Bar Kokhba, and says that from an objective, quantitative time perspective, the revolt of Bar Kokhba was simply premature. The Khurba had taken place a mere 70 years before. The Jews had not had an opportunity yet to regroup, to strengthen themselves. They weren't ready yet to take on the Roman Empire. However, the concept of qualitative time is that one can skip in time. Rav develops this in the context of Yetzias Mitzrayim, the fact that on one hand it's supposed to be 400 years, and then we only were slaves for 210 years, that we learned what we had to learn in less time, qualitative time, and we're able to move on to the next stage to follow Yetzias Mitzrayim. Rav stressed that the Jew of the Mesorah has a different concept of time. Revelation and tradition erase the boundaries of time. Now here, the Rav gives a perspective that may be seen as consistent with ahistoric, but certainly gives a new dimension to it. The Rav has, and I'm going to take from, not from Kodesh HaChol, but from the essay Ubikashta Misham, again the part that's easiest part to read in the essay, the part that was translated and came out in Hamavaser after the Rav passed away, this remarkable story which the Rav tells about his childhood of when his father was living in the home of his grandfather, not Rav Chaim, Rav Elia Prushin, his other grandfather. And he had a group of Talmidim who came and studied with him in the house, and the Rav was a little boy, and the shiur would revolve around the Rambam. And the Rav Moshe Zatzal would bring the Ravid's Hasaga, many questions, many problems with the Rambam, and try to answer the difficulties of the Rambam. And the Rav described himself as being fascinated by the Rambam, and you know, and want to defend the Rambam. He's always being attacked. Everybody's asking questions on his psak. And that in the shiur, often his father would somehow defend the Rambam, but there would be occasions where at the end of the shiur, his father would have to say, I can't help it, I have no answer. And he ran to his mother all upset, what's going to happen to the poor Rambam? Even father can't protect him, can't save him. And his mother assured him, there'll be another time, and who knows, maybe when you grow up, you'll be the one to explain and justify the Rambam. And then the Rav goes on to say, as he grew up, his sense of friendship went beyond the Rambam to the sense of all the Chachmei HaMesorah attending the Shiur, of seeing all the Chazal and all the Rishonim and the Achronim that were discussed in the Shir as not really be people who once lived, who had certain shitos in learning, certain approaches to learning, and certain resolutions of a specific halachic problem, but as live figures in some sense in the room. That the Shir erased the boundaries of time. Right? That all the generations are learning together. That somehow the halachic process, the learning, Limud HaTorah, erases the boundaries of time. So you could say that again, beyond history, erases the boundaries of time. Right? So we have a sense of halacha and of time that's not just the quantitative time, but a qualitative time, boundaries of time that no longer exists, because halacha is the bridge, revelation and tradition, halachic analysis that enables one to live with all the chachma and mesorah throughout history at the same moment. But interestingly, that the Rav, in the very same talk, again comes back to the Tahara component of Ketuvah, similar to the analysis I described in the Ish Halacha, where he talks about the Tahara ideal is to change the vectorial force of sin's direction and destination. Purification is nothing more but the anticipation of a more glorious future. Ideal is not repetition, but recreation on a higher level. The Rav, never static, dynamic, we're trying to recreate on a higher level, even transform this chet, the sin, not to erase it, to be forgiven by HaKadosh Baruch Hu alone, but to transform it, a process of change. So it's very strange. It's ahalachic, which would imagine it to be totally static, and yet it's dynamic, creative, even the past can be changed. Right? And it's always, it looks back and it looks forward at the same time. And by the way, in the very end of this particular essay, there's a paragraph which the Rav makes perhaps the strongest argument in favor of secular education that we find in his writings, in a most startling way. And I'm going to read a whole paragraph here. This concept of contrast and growth must serve as a practical preachment for the rabbinate today. Many rabbis have confided to me that the secular world they enter, once having left the environs of the yeshiva, jolts their values and threatens their ideology. This reorientation to new environments has become gradually one of the major problems of the young rabbi. But it is just this contrast that can serve as the true perspective for one's traditional values, not alone to regain and reaffirm from former comprehension and intuition, but to vouchsafe a new focus and enhanced endearment of values. It is only through this contrast of values with values, profane with sacred, that one may begin to grow in fortitude and self-realization. The secular world may serve even more than the religious to foster new concepts and overtones in the old. It must be understood that true consciousness of Kedusha comes in the dissatisfaction with the secular world through the principle of contrast. It is ever and on the prophet's revelation, "The Lord appears to me from afar," and the Lord from afar is dearer and more intriguing than the Lord from near. That it's only by confronting the world, contrasting with it, that we can grow religiously fully. This is from Kodesh and Chol, near the end of it. Right. Now I'm going to give you a series of works where the Rav suddenly becomes very historical and shifts completely, and hopefully I won't take so long. I really thought I'd have a whole hour, not 45 minutes, to show where there's a bridge. I'm not going to leave it just in conflict, even though I said the Rav isn't bothered by contradictions. The essay Kol Dodi Dofek, which I'm told has just been translated into English. I haven't seen the English issue. The Rav's response to the Holocaust and to the emergence of the State of Israel. Now clearly this is written as a response to very profound historical events, and can't be answered in a non-historical way. The Rav talks about the birth of the State of Israel, the six knocks that the Kaddish Baruch was knocking on the door, and each one reflects something else. And essentially, the knocks deal not with halachic issues, but the effect on the Jewish people, our interaction with the world, what it tells about the Jewish destiny and Jewish functioning. Interestingly, very little halacha in this discussion. And the question becomes, how do we respond to these knocks? That's the image of Kol Dodi Dofek taken from Shir HaShirim, that HaKadosh Baruch Hu is the beloved who knocks on the door, and we delay and don't respond in time, and therefore he disappears, and if we have Hester upon him again. And how do we respond to these knocks? And in this, the Rav develops the notion of the double covenant. And interestingly, in typical Rav fashion, I'm going to give you another article in 2 minutes in which he describes a different double covenant. But they're both significant. In Kol Dodi Dofek, the Rav talks about Bris Sinai and Bris Mitzrayim, the covenant of Sinai and the covenant of Egypt. The covenant of Sinai, the one we're familiar with, he described as Bris Yiud, or a covenant of betrothal, one of where we play an active role. It's the covenant of Torah. It's the covenant of mitzvahs, of commandments. There's also a covenant of Egypt, of Mitzrayim, which is a bris goro, a covenant of destiny, of Jewish destiny, to which all Jews share. So the Rav now has introduced a very historical notion, which is non-halachic completely. It's the notion of being part of a destiny of a people, which is also an integral part of Judaism. Right? It's nowhere to be found, isha halacha, but suddenly we're part of a Jewish destiny, as Jews. And the Rav was wont to say, I didn't find this particular article, but heard from him numerous times, describing the response of Ruth to Naomi, the convert. Ruth says, Amech ami velokayach elokoi. Two things. Not just Elokayach Elokai, that I accept Judaism. I expect all the halachic requirements and the philosophy of Judaism, but I identify myself with Amech, with the Jewish people. And in practical terms, it's part of the Geirus. That the prospective convert is told, why do you want to be Jewish? The Jews are treated so badly, they suffer, they're looked down upon by most of the nations of the world. Why do you want to take it? That's the first question asked. If you look, by the way, in Rabbi Bezdin Alba Shalom's first volume, Reflections of the Rav, he has a piece on the which comes first, the Paradum and the Chata, and then the Pesach, in which he talks that one has to choose somehow between identifying with Jewish peoplehood and with a Kaddish Baruch Hu. But clearly, both notions exist, right, in the Rav's sense. Interestingly, in Shiurei HaRav, the Rav has a piece called The Covenantal Community, and there the Rav describes, again, two covenants, but not the same two. There the Rav talks about the covenant of Sinai again, commitment to fulfillment of commandments, and the patriarchal covenant, the Bris Avos, going back to Avram and Sarah, which teaches us how to feel our Jewishness, how to function as a Jew, which goes beyond the formality of mitzvahs. It deals with faith, it deals with love, it deals with feeling. No longer the objective a priori halacha alone. In another talk, which appears in Shiurei HaRav, which was said to the Balei and Balos Tshuva, who represented the Orlando Benson Society, which when Yeshiva had its seminars for high school students who were totally not observant. I'm not talking about yeshiva high school students. For public school students, and there was a society in memory of this Yolanda Benson who had become observant and was killed in a car accident. The Rav spoke about the unique experience of Judaism, spoke about experiential memory, experiential anticipation, and the Jew being old and young, living in the past and living in the future. So we have a very interesting, it's an historical consciousness, but one that at the same time goes beyond the boundaries of history. Because I don't only live in this moment. The Jew lives in the past and in the future simultaneously. And that's what's unique about Judaism. We're very aware of history, but we don't live only in one historical moment and respond to it. But we encompass all of it. Again, all the Chachmei Masorah sitting in the Shir, all learning together, bridging the generations, but even onward to the future. What I think really brings things to a head is a couple of lines in the Hesped the Rav gave for his uncle Rav Zalvel Zatzal, called Madodech Midod. In this Hesped, in which he really reiterates the perspective of the Isha Halacha, applying it to Rav Chaim and to Rav Zalvel, the Rav discusses Rav Zalvel's attitude towards the state of Israel. And the Rav said that Rav Zalvel was not anti-Israel, he was not pro-Israel. Israel didn't exist. Sounds absurd, because Israel did exist. It didn't exist for Rav Zalvel because it fit into no halachic category. And existence, and this really relates back to Ish Halacha, a priori halachic constructs, existence is a reflection of halacha. And if something, a secular Jewish state, does not have a single halachic category, then for all intents and purposes, it doesn't exist. Yes, there are people running a government, but there's no concept, construct, to fit it in. After explaining Rav Zalvel's position, the Rav makes comment about a yesh omrim who disagree. Some would disagree, and it's quite clear, of course, that the yesh omrim is referring to himself. And the Rav says, is that the position of some who differed, is in my English translation, not an accurate one, halacha must have something to say about every historical event. He rejects Rav Zalvel's position because halacha cannot allow an area of life, not just a physical object in life, but a historical event to be outside the halachic process. So now suddenly we see the shift from the description of the halachic man who has everything in purely objective halachic terms, and if it doesn't fit, that's it. And the Rav's own position, which is that there must be a way of applying halacha to it. Now, however, one can interpret this position of the Rav in two ways. One is to say that it really hasn't shifted from halachic man in the slightest. All he says is that Rav Zalvel's position that this doesn't fit, he doesn't accept. There's no such thing as something doesn't fit. You have to find a way to make it fit, because halacha has to apply to everything. But there's also an alternative way of viewing it, which I think is much more reflective of the Rav's position. And I'm going to give you some indication of both of them in the quotations from the Chamesh Drashot, which I think appears in English as six Drashot or something. Five addresses, I don't know. I'm familiar with, most familiar with the Hebrew version. Of course, the original, by the way, was Yiddish, because that was the way it was written. And in Yiddish, it was Fear Drasher. They kept, when they translated, they added later talks, and it became more each time. Here, I want to make reference to the first Drasha and into the fifth one. In the first Drasha, which is entitled Joseph's Dream, the Rav discusses the dispute between the biblical Yosef, Joseph, and his brothers. And describes the dispute in terms of viewing the future. That Yosef understood that the Jews were going to face a changing environment. They were not going to be able to spend all their history living in Eretz Canaan and always remain Roei Tzon shepherds, but they were going to have to face a golus, that's go out in the world. They're going to be shift economically to a different kind of society. It's the imagery of the dream of Anachnu Ma'am Malum Mitoch Asada, of the Jews gathering sheaves of wheat in the field, even though they weren't farmers, they were shepherds. Seems to be an incorrect imagery. That's exactly the point, according to the Rav. Yosef said, we're not always going to be shepherds, we have to be able to deal with different realities. And the brothers said, this is our tradition, this is our way, we're not going to change. Now, the interesting interpretation of the dispute between Yosef and his brothers is not the critical point. The critical point is the Rav said, while in halachic disputes, the Jewish scholars decide, referring to Tanash Lachinoi, the famous machlokas between Rabbi Elazar and Chachamim, where Rabbi Yeshua concludes, lo bashamayim hi, the decision even against the baskol, against the divine voice, the decision in halacha is given over to the Chachamim to determine. But in historical questions of Jewish destiny, God decides. However, in the dispute between Yosef and his brothers, that was a question of Jewish destiny, of Jewish history. And here, HaKadosh Baruch Hu spoke through history and decided that Yosef was right. And the Rav goes by analogy from the story of Yosef and his brothers in Bereishis to the dispute between Mizrahi and Aguda to the Zionist movement, seeing many Gedolei Yisrael, many the great leaders of Israel reflecting the position of Yosef's brothers, will always be in Europe, will always be in the shtetl. We have to maintain totally what we did. And Yosef's response, and he has it, of course, being the founder of Mizrahi, Europe may be destroyed. The world's going to change. We are prepared to function in a very different environment. The time has come to make a historical move to go back to Israel, to function in history in a very different way. And the Rav here again sees HaKadosh Baruch Hu speaking through history. Europe is destroyed. Israel emerges. Some of this is called Odido fake as well. So as well as having things function totally within a halachic context, there's an interaction with history taking place. And in this interaction, HaKadosh Baruch Hu speaks to us through history. Again, focus on Jewish destiny, the double covenant, the covenant that reflects itself in mitzvot, that's halacha, and the covenant that reflects itself in the history of the Jewish people and in Jewish destiny. Now, in the last of the five drashot, called Mital HaShemayim Mishmanei Yaretz, and the dew of the heaven and the fat of the earth, the Rav makes two points. One is he describes the establishment of the State of Israel as a miraculous event of enormous historical significance for our period. Not like Ravel was saying, I can't fit it in, but my sense of history, Jewish destiny, or the Rav's sense, tells them this is a great and enormous historical significance and therefore has to be dealt with and appreciated. And then the Rav, so to speak, adds a 14th animamen to the Rambam, a 14th article of faith, that this Torah can be completely fulfilled in all places and all times, in all societies, economies, and cultures, particularly in a modern technological society. The Rav rejects the notion that there's any part of the world that is immune to the applicability of Torah. a clear rejection of the notion that we must go back to the ghetto and withdraw from the world, because we can only have Torah in a certain setting, in a certain environment, that the Torah cannot function in this world or that world, in that culture, in the other society. Now, this does not mean that one accepts every aspect of society. But that means that one doesn't run away from the society, doesn't run away from the issues of society, doesn't run away from the changes, technological and cultural, that take place in society. Remember what I said from Kaddish Chol, it's the interaction, the contrast, and where growth takes place. Now, with this, one going back to the Hesped for Avraham, one could say, based on this 14th Animamin, the Rav's position is not a historical one, but that he rejected Rav Elvel's position because the Torah applies to every situation. If there's a state of Israel, the Torah applies to that too. It has to apply to everything. But I think, while that is certainly a possibility, I think that has to be combined with the first approach that I reflected from the Rav, that the historical event having enormous significance, reflecting a turn in Jewish destiny, has to be, put in. Not just because halacha has to apply to it, but because God speaks through history as well. And if the two notions are never fully put together, remember, the Rav was never concerned about that. There's more than one truth. There's an objective halachic system, a priori, irrespective of the said. There's been a dispute that came up in the latter years of the Rav's life, and unfortunately the Rav wasn't well enough to respond, what was the Rav's position in the Chatzchila and B'dieved? Did the Rav accept secular education as a necessity or as desirable? Right? We know the distinction halachic between the Chatzchila and B'dieved. Let's apply it, for example, to women's learning. I heard directly the Rav we know the distinction halachic between the chatzchila and the b'dieved. Let's apply it, for example, to women's learning. I heard directly the Rav defending. Right? We know the distinction halachic between the chatzchila and b'dieved. Let's apply it, for example, to women's learning. I mean, I heard directly the Rav defending women learning Torah Shabbat Peh, in particular Gemara, on the grounds that the same argument that applied in the time of the Chafetz Chaim, that when the Polish and Russian women, Jewish women were getting some secular education, that they needed a corresponding Jewish education, in the modern world where women are getting a university education going on in graduate programs and are getting a much more sophisticated kind of education, that the Jewish education has to grow correspondingly, which the Rav, of course, means Torah Shabbat Peh, because that's the highest level of Jewish learning, that's halacha, which everything I've said up till now obviously indicates. So if you would ask, what was the Rav's position in women's learning? Is it l'chatchila b'di'evet? And I am not quoting the Rav now. This is my interpretation, making it very clear. Is that he really would have rejected the question. Torah is applicable in all societies in all times. There is an objective halachic system that interacts with a world that keeps on changing. There's a Jewish destiny that's operating in the world, and it's simply a changing world in many, many ways. And the halacha has the capacity to respond to the reality of that particular time. So it may very well be true that if you would have asked the halacha at the time of the Rambam, should women learn Gemara, in terms of the world of that time, one would have gotten one response. And in terms of the world of the end of the 20th century, one gets a different response. Is the 13th century lechatchila, is the 20th century lechatchila? That's not the, misses the point. The point is that Torah that's applicable and responds to the world in all times, in all societies, there has to be an appropriate halachic response in each situation. So therefore, the question's no question. The appropriate response for this society in this time may be, in this particular case, different than the appropriate response in an earlier historical period in a different kind of a society. Now, that doesn't mean that you can simply modify halacha at will. I don't mean that at all. It means in very specific ways, in specific contexts. But to the Rav, the question of when someone asked him, if you feel you gained so much from exposure to secular education, that mean the Rav Chaim somehow was lacking because he didn't have it? The Rav found the question almost offensive. Rav Chaim was appropriate for Rav Chaim's setting. The Rav responded what he felt was appropriate in his time and his setting. And if one allows for an interaction with a dynamic world, with some sense of history, and I realize there's a paradox here. On one point, the Rav's sense of history is to reject quantitative and replace with qualitative time and to see a continuum of history, right? All the generations at once. And on the other hand, the Rav has a tremendous awareness of historical change and of a destiny that's not always the same with the Jewish people, and of responding to the circumstance God places us by putting us on this world at any particular time. So while there's a tension between the two, it doesn't mean that the two don't both operate and are not true simultaneously. Yeah, any questions? Yeah. And those of you who have to go to classes, please. Yeah. What do you mean by no?
Of course, the Yerushalmi and Chala, where there's a machlokes ha-tanayim about oriz v'deichem. When you mix rice with water, is it bole de-chimuz or is it bole de-silchon? If it's bole de-chimuz, then rice and water, if you make a rice cake, it'll be hamoitzi and it'll be birchus hamoz, and you can use it for matzah and to erev a chatzeris. And if it's only bole de-silchon, it's not an achmeshes mini dogon, then it's no good for matzah, and it'll never be hamotzi, and never be birchas hamotzi, and it's no good for eri chaser. So the Gemara asks the question, so this Machlokes HaTanaim is a Machlokes HaMetzius. So why didn't they experiment and find out? Why didn't they mix the rice with water, the rice flour with water, and let it sit for a couple of hours, and then look at it and see whether it was Sirchon or it was Timur? So Yerushalmi said that's what they did. They did experiment, and they looked at it, and then that was the Machlokes HaTanaim. Where do you draw the line to distinguish between Timur and Sirchon? It's a vague line. The thin line, that was the Machlokes. The Ramban quotes that passage in Yerushalmi to demonstrate that it never really makes sense to have a Machlokes and Metzius. Whenever there's such a Machlokes anymore, you have to assume that it's usually a Machlokes if it's in Svara or something. Yeah, but sometimes you have no alternative. So here it's a Machlokes in Metzius that you can't really test, because you have to test all the people in the world from the days of Adam Arish until the days of Mashiach. But I'm going to just say the people in this community have a different mentality. Sometimes you have a different mentality. The Hungarians have a different mentality from the Galiciana, who have a different mentality from the Vitzbach. Very different from the Yekis. There are people in different periods of history, and people from different backgrounds, whether you're wealthy or poor and so on, will have a different mentality about paying Techazman as opposed to waiting till Lachazman. There will be different mentalities. What are you going to make? You're going to keep on switching the Hazokah. It's very hard. You're going to keep on switching the Ruby the Lake to come on or the Hazok every 5 years. If you had a good year, but then Adam Perea Tasman, if you had a bad year, so you're going to pinch and save all the pennies. You're going to wait till 2 weeks after the debt is overdue, and then you're going to pay. It's hard. From the summer, they were arguing their cloud over the course of a few centuries. So you can't take a fall. And Echanami, the Pasha Pshat and Nigmar is that it is a Machloitis and it's some it was just too, it was impossible to take a poll. But that, again, that's how Tesis explains. We're talking about a case that he has no migul. If he has a migul, then Nigmar has an Ibaid Lev Shita on the bottom of Amad Beis, going over to the top of Avam Manala. That's an Ibaid Lev Shita, whether the migul is good, even when it's contradicted by the role of Chazaka, Einan Amparet Osmano, or not. We discussed the other day that he violated Shita. To the beginning of this, so he's not talking about a situation where you have Nigel. He has no Nigel. How come he doesn't have a Nigel? When is he asking for the money? When is he asking for the money? So the way we have the gears in the Gemara, you can say that he comes and he's Taveh Tosmano. The Taveh comes Techazman and he asks for the money. And the Nitzvah says, Praiticha. But then the Shlopi says, he's Ein and Nem. Taisus had a different gear to them. The bottom Taisus begins with the words that are missing in our Gemara. Ubo bizmano v'yama praticha tezmano. He comes bizmano. We don't have that gear from the Gemara. In the Masoras HaShasa is base. He points out that there's another gear in this Achacher. Ubo bizmano, the Mashal points out that according to Taisus, they had a different gear from the Gemara. We don't really have that. According to Taisus, he comes on the Yom HaGoes HaZman. On the Yom HaPiro'on. But that's what Taisus says. So what do you mean? He comes on the Yom HaPiro'on. And he kind of praticha b'tel z'mani. Why isn't that? Why doesn't he have a migu? Why isn't he has a migu? He could have said praticha hayom. That's Taisus kasha. So Taisus comes up with an answer that we really don't paskin like. The end of the Taisus. It says the migu de ha'ozim. To say praticha hayom, if he really didn't, is a tremendous question. The guy comes at a quarter to two and he says, where's the money? He says, what do you mean? I just paid you the money an hour ago. You must have Alzheimer's. You're getting senile at a young age. 20 years old, you're already senile. The patient says, that's amigo de Ozzy. He says, Praticha, I paid you a month ago. You know, 2 weeks ago, a month ago is enough time to forget. But he can't say, I just paid you an hour ago. When did he pay him? He just finished davening shakras at 9:30. He went to the 8:30 minyan. He just finished davening shakras at 9:30. So when did he pay him? The guy forgot already that he paid.